From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Every person is hereby ordered to immediately evacuate the city of New Orleans.
I'm talking about tens of thousands of people who are left behind, and those are the sickest, the oldest, poorest, the youngest, the people with disabilities and the like, and the plan was that everybody should leave. Well, you can't leave if you're in a hospital. You can't leave if you're a nurse. You can't leave if you're a patient. You can't leave if you're in a nursing home. You can't leave if you don't have a car.
Hurricane Katrina, 1 year later. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New Orleans is marking the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. A series of vigils are being held to remember the more than 1,500 victims who died when the storm breached levees and submerged 80% of the city. Wreaths are being laid at the site of each successive levee breach. A funeral procession of jazz musicians is to wind through New Orleans streets in one of the city's oldest traditions. President Bush is expected to attend a prayer service at the city's convention center, where thousands of people were left stranded without food and medical aid. On Monday, Bush gave a speech in Biloxi, Mississippi. The president emphasized his number of visits to the Gulf Coast.
Since the days of heroism and bravery, the Gulf Coast has begun one of the largest rebuilding efforts in our nation's history. This is my 11th visit since the storm hit. You know, each visit you see progress. I was struck by the beauty of the beaches. The beaches were pretty rough after the storm, as you know. Today, they're pristine and they're beautiful. They reflect a hopeful future. As far as I'm concerned.
The New York Times reports President Bush delivered his remarks, quote, against a carefully orchestrated backdrop of neatly reconstructed homes. Just a few feet out of camera range stood gutted houses with wires dangling from interior ceilings. A tattered piece of crime scene tape hung from a tree in the field where Mr. Bush spoke. A toilet seat lay on its side in the grass. Meanwhile, the man who became the face of the Bush administration's highly criticized response to the crisis took the occasion of Katrina's one-year mark to lash out at his former superiors in the White House. Former FEMA director Michael Brown spoke to reporters in Washington.
No, we're not prepared. Now, I do believe that one of the most fascinating things I've heard the past couple of days is that Secretary Chertoff came out and made this statement, something to the effect that we must start doing catastrophic planning, and it's going to take us years to do that. I find it fascinating that I've been saying that since 2003, and now in 2006, they're saying we've got to do this planning. So my hope is that they're actually doing it. If they are, that means we're on the path to being prepared. If they're not, then shame on the administration, and we need to slap them around and make certain that we start doing that kind of planning and preparation.
Former FEMA director Michael Brown will have more from New Orleans after headlines. In international news, Mexico's top electoral court has rejected allegations last month's presidential election was marred with fraud. A panel of judges ruled a partial recount has not changed results that gave Felipe Calderón a razor-thin victory over Andrés Manuel López Obrador. López Obrador claims the voting was rigged and has demanded a full recount of all polling stations. Speaking in front of thousands of supporters in Mexico City, López Obrador vowed to continue the fight.
The official computation given by the Electoral Tribunal of Judicial Power of the Federation, which intends to legalize the fraud committed on July 2, 2006, is not recognized. Second, the usurpation is rejected, and Mr. Felipe Calderón is not recognized as the President of the Republic.
The UN's top humanitarian official says Darfur is on the brink of a new humanitarian disaster threatening massive loss of life. Emergency Relief Coordinator Jan Eglin spoke from the UN on Monday.
We're now close to having a free fall of our operation in Darfur. We have the worst security situation since 2004. We have the worst access since 2004. We have some of the worst atrocities since 2004. The way it is now, it cannot continue. Many aid organizations are now debating internally whether they should leave Darfur because they cannot anymore provide assistance in an effective manner and because they've lost too many colleagues.
Jan Egeland went on to call for increased humanitarian aid and a stronger peacekeeping force. His comments come as Amnesty International warns the Sudanese military is engaged in a massive buildup of troops in preparation for a new offensive against Darfurian rebel groups. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is in Lebanon to tour devastated areas and shore up support for a larger peacekeeping force. Annan was in the town of Nakura earlier today, where he attended a ceremony honoring the 5 UN workers killed during Israel's 34-day invasion. In Beirut Monday, Annan called on Israel to end its blockade of Lebanon and said Hezbollah should release 2 captured Israeli soldiers.
In Lebanon, there should be, as we have all agreed, one law, one authority, one gun. I imagine my Israeli interlocutors to lift immediately the blockade on Lebanon, and I'm working with them and other international partners to see to it that this is done. I also renew my call for the abducted soldiers to be freed, and as a first step, to be transferred under the auspices of ICRC, either to the government of Lebanon or to a third party.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. An Israeli airstrike on the Gaza Strip has wounded at least 8 Palestinians, including innocent bystanders. The strike comes one day after thousands of Palestinians attended the funerals of 4 Palestinian civil servants killed in an Israeli bombing earlier that day. More than 180 Palestinians, more than half of them civilian, have been killed in Israeli air attacks on Gaza since June. On Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh criticized the latest violence.
The Palestinian government denounces the ugly massacres that the Israeli occupation forces carry out in the West Bank and Gaza. The most recent was the killing of 8 people in Gaza. Among them were 4 members of the security forces and the continued killing of citizens of Khan Yunis and Nablus and Jabalia. Israeli forces regularly continue to commit these massacres under a political framework against Palestinian civilians, in particular targeting residential buildings.
Meanwhile, Israel's confirmed the arrest of another elected Palestinian member of parliament. About 20 army vehicles surrounded the home of Hamas MP Mahmoud Mesleth Sunday near Ramallah. Dozens of Hamas officials and government members have been arrested over the past 2 months. In Israel, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has ordered an inquiry into the handling of the war on Lebanon, but he's refused to allow the independent investigation demanded by growing critics within the government and the military. The announcement came hours after government investigators accused Olmert of making a series of questionable political appointments when he served as trade and industry minister. In Iraq, the death toll from the last 2 days of violence has now topped 100. In Diwaniyah, at least 28 people were killed in what the New York Times calls the most brazen clashes in recent memory between the Iraq army and forces loyal to Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Earlier today, the Iraqi government announced it had reached a truce with Sadr's militia to end the fighting there. The Independent of London reports more than 10,000 Iraqis have been killed in the last 4 months. In other Iraq news, United Press International is reporting at least 2 new Iraqi military units have refused to go into battle. Just last week, about 100 Iraqi soldiers refused to be deployed alongside U.S. troops in Baghdad in a mission called Operation Together Forward. Another group of Iraqi troops has refused orders to fight alongside the U.S. in Ramadi. British Prime Minister Tony Blair's continued support for the Bush administration is coming under criticism from former President Jimmy Carter. In an interview with the London Daily Telegraph, Carter said he's disappointed Blair did not stand up to President Bush over the invasion of Iraq. Carter said, quote, "My own personal opinion is that the Iraqi people are not better off as a result of the invasion, and people in America and Great Britain are not safer. It's a shameful and pitiful state of affairs, and I hold Tony Blair to be substantially responsible for being so compliant and subservient," said the former president, Jimmy Carter. In Afghanistan, at least 17 people were killed and 47 injured when a suicide bombing struck a market in Helmand province. A Taliban spokesperson said the group intended to target a former police chief who served under the pro-Russian government 2 decades ago. Afghan President Hamid Karzai called the bombing a heinous act. One of Africa's deadliest wars could be at a major turning point as a truce goes into effect today. The Ugandan government and the rebel group Lord's Resistance Army have agreed to a ceasefire that will see the LRA withdraw its forces over the next 3 weeks. Over 100,000 people have been killed, nearly 2 million displaced in Uganda's 20-year conflict. And finally, the oldest prisoner at Guantanamo Bay has been released. Haji Nasrat Khan was sent back to Afghanistan over the weekend. Khan is at least 71 years old. He claims he was arrested after complaining to U.S. troops about the arrest of his son. According to his lawyer, U.S. authorities never charged him with a crime, nor even told him why he'd been imprisoned. Khan had to use a walker to make his way around Guantanamo. At one military hearing, he reportedly told prosecutors, quote, "How could I be an enemy combatant if I was not able to stand up?" Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today marks the first anniversary of the Hurricane Katrina disaster. The storm was the most powerful and expensive natural disaster to hit the United States, one of the deadliest hurricanes recorded in the country. Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, displacing some 770,000 residents, destroying over 300,000 homes. More than 1,500 people were killed in New Orleans alone. In the early morning of August 29, 2005, Katrina's storm surge caused several breaches in levees around New Orleans. 80% of the city was subsequently submerged. Images of New Orleans residents piling into the city's Superdome Stadium and Convention Center pleading for food, water, and aid were broadcast around the world. Today, we spend the hour on Hurricane Katrina. We'll look at issues ranging from race and class to the media's coverage of the disaster and ongoing struggles in public housing and the criminal justice system. We'll be speaking with the editor of the Times-Picayune, author of a new book called Breach of Faith. But first, we remember some of Democracy Now!'s coverage of Katrina. Let's go back 1 year ago to New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish I had better news for you, but we are facing a storm that most of us have feared. Every person is hereby ordered to immediately evacuate the city of New Orleans, or, if no other alternative is available, to immediately move to one of the facilities within the city that will be designated as a refuge of last resort.
And the Gulf Coast region remain in a state of catastrophe following the devastating Hurricane Katrina. At least 80% of New Orleans is underwater. The city has no electricity and little drinkable water. Officials say New Orleans will be uninhabitable for weeks. On Tuesday, two levees broke, flooding areas of the city that appeared to survive the storm.
This is a national disaster. Get every doggone Greyhound bus line in the country and get their asses moving to New Orleans. That's they thinking small, man, and this is a major, major, major deal.
Talking about tens of thousands of people who are left behind, and those are the sickest, the oldest, poorest, the youngest, the people with disabilities and the like, and the plan was that everybody should leave. Well, you can't leave if you're in a hospital. You can't leave if you're a nurse. You can't leave if you're a patient. You can't leave if you're in a nursing home. You can't leave if you don't have a car.
There are throngs of people, easily in the tens of thousands, maybe 40 to 50,000 people, in my estimation, standing on this plaza trying to get to a very narrow area where they're being escorted to the buses. I haven't seen one bus leave yet.
Please, babe. 6 and 8 months. The people just walking past us.
No food, no water, no nothing. Whatever we had, we've been taking it. That's the only way we could survive.
They got the food right here. Let me show you right here. All of it. Look, right here. Look. They don't want to give us nothing. Nothing.
Look. Open the gate right there.
Look. They don't want to give us nothing. We ain't drinking no ice water, nothing.
This is not about low income. It's not about rich people, poor people. It's about people. Nobody wants to hurt anybody in this city. Nobody wants to hurt these people who have these businesses. And they want a little air and a little food and water, for God's sake. That's it.
There's nobody in charge. The National Guard, the police, there is nobody. Somebody needs to come take charge and put organization and get these people to safety, to get them clothes, the basic things that they need to live from day to day.
Well, we've been people being killed down here. People, some of their bodies were just lying out in the street. They were shooting each other. The military was shooting. One of my neighbors said the military guy shot at him. So that's what made me not want to come down here.
Fed relief officials have played almost no role. The head of FEMA, Michael Brown, admitted on CNN last night his agency didn't even know that thousands of hungry refugees were inside the convention center. Residents continue to break into stores in search of everything from food and water to guns to luxury items.
Nobody here but us, and we just got to look out for one another. All your politicians, they want to get on TV talking about they're feeding this person, feeding that person. We ain't seen nothing over here yet.
The White House announced it would have zero tolerance for looters, even for those taking essential items needed to stay alive.
Well, I want zero tolerance for that kind of language being used by leaders of our government to discuss poor people, poor black people who are trying to survive under the most desperate, insane circumstances. I want zero tolerance for thousands of our troops being sent to Iraq when we need them here.
I hate the way they portray us in the media. If you see a black family, it says they're looting. See a white family, it says they're looking for food. George Bush doesn't care about black people.
In Biloxi, Mississippi, the first federal aid arrived only yesterday, 3 full days after the storm wiped out entire sections of the city. In smaller towns in Mississippi, help has still not arrived.
We left for the hurricane and came back Monday night hoping that we could help some people because, I don't know, looking at the response to this storm, particularly initially, there wasn't a lot of outside help, so we decided that really it was up to the people of Jefferson Parish to take the parish back.
What I saw from the federal government was a grand total of 3 boats, Border Patrol agents on 3 boats, 2 airboats and 1 flat-bottom boat. And I saw far more of a response from citizens who had just taken it upon themselves to go and pluck people out of their homes, and they plucked about a dozen out on Saturday.
We don't have any government response here. Everything that's taken place is taken place by volunteers and citizens in the area. Why aren't there 50 inflatable boats in the water working a grid, making sure all these people are out of here? Why is it just volunteers? That's the only people you see around.
FEMA Director Mike Brown is in charge of all federal response and recovery efforts in the field.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
That's Democratic true. Leader Nancy Pelosi has called for your resignation, and I'm wondering if you have a response to that.
The president's in charge of that, not me.
Well, right at the top, you have Michael Brown, and as you mentioned, he was the commissioner of judges at the International Arabian Horse Association. To give you an idea of what he did there, he spent a year investigating whether a breeder performed liposuction on a horse's rear end.
This is an attempt by some in this room to engage in finger-pointing and blame game, and I'm just not going to do that. I've made it very clear. I've made it very clear, and the president spoke about him last week, and his comments stand in terms of what he said about the great work that they've been doing round the clock, 24 hours a day, to help people on the ground.
Katrina and its aftermath 1 year ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, that produced by Democracy Now!'s John Hamilton. When we come back, Jed Horn joins us, Metro editor of the Times-Picayune. He's written the book Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City. Stay with us.
I'm going to need to pay.
I get through walking these blues, when I get back to New Orleans. I've got my suitcase in my hand. Now ain't that a shame? I'm leaving here today. Yes, I'm going back home to stay. Yes, I'm walking to New Orleans. You used to be my honey, till you spent all my money. No use for you to cry, I see you by and by, 'cause I'm walking to New Orleans. Got no time for talking. I've got to keep on walking. New Orleans is my home. That's the reason why I'm gone. Yes.
Fats Domino, walking to New Orleans. Fats Domino was one of the victims of Hurricane Katrina. When the hurricane hit, the staff of the New Orleans major newspaper, the Times-Picayune, went to work. And they were working first from their offices, then when they were flooded out, they went to Baton Rouge. We're joined right now by one of the editors of the Times-Picayune, Jed Horn. He wrote Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina, and the Near Death of a Great American City, part of the team that won two Pulitzer Prizes for their coverage of the hurricane. The Times-Picayune, forced to evacuate the building where the paper was housed, set up operations in Baton Rouge, continued to publish daily and chronicle the unfolding catastrophe that was taking place in their city. In its September 4th edition, the Times-Picayune published a blistering open letter to President Bush, criticizing him for the federal government's response to Hurricane Katrina, calling for the firing of FEMA Chief Michael Brown. The paper subsequently again won those two Pulitzers. Jed Horn, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. You covered the catastrophe. You were a part of the catastrophe. Go back a year and tell us the personal story of you and the paper and how you dealt with this.
Well, I think the paper rallied as a team magnificently, and I can claim only a small part in that effort. I was also one of the very lucky ones in the sense that my house did not flood. And so it was possible to turn that into a kind of a boarding house for all the folks whose houses, or not all of them, God knows, but some of them whose houses had flooded. I found myself working with people who, were essentially homeless people, and yet the sense of urgency was only that much greater and galvanic in putting out those papers.
And so you did it day after day, and as your city was shredded, you blistered the federal government. Were you surprised by the response of the government? How much did you and the paper, your community in New Orleans, understand as the hurricane was coming to town?
We certainly understood the gravity of the situation, as the federal government should have. There had been, after all, the exercise called Hurricane Pam, which was a dress rehearsal for just this kind of event. In which as many as 60,000 deaths, if I recall, were anticipated in the mock-up. There's no doubt that New Orleans is at risk for hurricanes. The shocking thing was how complete and abject the failure of the federal response turned out to be, that it should take the better part of a week for the richest country in the world to get some buses a few miles into a floodplain, indeed into the parts of it that hadn't even flooded, which were fully accessible, as the media demonstrated day after day after day. For some reason, the feds couldn't quite get that together. And that was different, because I'll tell you the truth, here in the South, where we're prone to a sense of federal oppression and federal meddling and this kind of omnipotent federal presence, it was startling to realize how completely incompetent the Bush administration was in this instance.
You begin your book by talking about Petrina Peters. Tell us about her story.
Well, Petrina Peters was a remarkable figure for me. She was a resident of the Lower Ninth Ward, and she taught me a number of lessons. She's one of those people, I think we all had a kind of helicopter's eye view of this devastation as it first unfolded. We'd seen people on the rooftops waving their arms around and desperate for help. In the course of trying to recreate these events, I wanted to get into the heads of those people and understand what it was like, as it was for Petrina, to be on the rooftop with her daughter clinging to them as the pieces of asbestos shingling flew by and as they begged for their lives from the Almighty and broke into hymns, to have that whole house lift up off the ground and be floated towards what they were certain was going to be their death. I followed several lives like that through sort of threading them through a narrative that lasts about, you know, 8 months to a year, trying to understand the changes that this catastrophe brought and the decisions that they made in the aftermath of that storm strike. I was not interested exclusively in Petrina, although her story was fascinating. She was exemplary of something a lot of people don't realize about the Lower Ninth Ward, which was that many of those residents were homeowners, many of them were self-sufficient, and interestingly, many of them chose to stay. There's a hurricane culture here that causes people, for out of just sheer stubbornness perhaps, and also a sense of obligation to their property, to tough it out. I spent time as well with Charmaine Neville, who had the exceedingly ghastly experience of staggering through floodwaters to safety, only then to be raped on a rooftop. I spent time with a guy named Earl Farrell, who fascinated me because Earl was, by popular accounts, a crook. He was hijacking cars. He was looting stores for his girlfriend. He was also providing survival-level provision for his community. There's a line that separates survivalism from wanton looting, and it was interesting to me to understand where that line lay. I spent time with politicians, I spent time with media people, trying to understand where the obligation to participate in rescue missions ended and the professional responsibility to simply document the horror began. And all of that kind of verges on a chorus of lives, a thread, a braid of lives that show us kind of the grit and resolve that's going to bring New Orleans back.
Jed, I wanted to ask you about the dead bodies. When we went down to New Orleans to cover the story, community organizer Malik Rahim, who is co-founder of the Common Ground Collective, took us to Algiers, showed us a dead body that had been there for days, actually for weeks.
Now, his body been here for almost 2 weeks, 2 weeks tomorrow, all right? That this man been laying here. And there's no reason for it. Look where we at. I mean, it's not flooded. There's no reason for them to be and left that body right here like this. I mean, that's just totally disrespect. You know, and I mean, 2 weeks. Every day we ask him about come and pick it up. And they refused to come and pick it up.
As Malik Rahim was speaking, as if on cue, every level of authority he mentioned drove by.
There's a dead body right here. Who are you with?
We're with Bravo 15.
Which is?
The CAV.
Army.
Army, yes, regular Army.
There's a dead body right here. Can you guys pick it up?
I don't think we can pick it up, but we can call the local authorities to come and pick it up.
There's a dead body right here. Can Louisiana State Troopers, can you pick it up?
You need to talk to our public information officer, ma'am.
It's been here for 2 weeks. We filmed it last week, and gentleman over here said he's been trying to get it picked up for 2 weeks, and Louisiana State Troopers, the police, the Army, no one has responded. We're looking right over at it right there.
You need to talk to our public information officer.
Do you know what they should do to get this body removed?
I have no idea. I can't tell you. I don't know. There's been several people over here looking at it.
Our sector is just this area here. And
so this is right in your sector?
Yes.
So that body is right in your sector?
Yes.
So what should happen then?
Well, what I can do in my position is notify my chain of command and leave it up to them to make those bigger decisions. It'd be out of my hands. I'm just at a lower level position.
There's this dead body over there. Would the Army take it out?
No, that's not really in our jurisdiction. We can't do any type of police work, so that's not for us to handle. We can only report it and hope that the cops take care of it, but we can't do anything.
You New Orleans police?
Yes, ma'am. I don't, can't talk, though.
There's a dead body over here, and we're wondering if the police would pick it up.
I have no comment on that, ma'am. You're going to have to call one of the press guys. Sorry.
Democracy Now! In New Orleans a year ago, Jed Horn, FEMA said that the media was not to show dead bodies. Your response?
Well, the media had an obligation to show dead bodies and fortunately defied FEMA and did just that. You're looking at an instance of bureaucracy and all of its stumble-bum absurdity at work there. The body that Malik drew your attention to was one of course, hundreds of bodies that sat there for weeks, if not months on end. In fact, I promise you that as they pull down the last of the houses that simply cannot be salvaged, they will find additional bodies under the rubble. That's been happening as recently as a month or two ago. I spoke at length with a guy named Gregory Richardson, who figures prominently in Breach of Faith as a guy of means, a wealthy man, self-made, product of the lower Ninth Ward, who went on to put together a real estate empire. And he realized as he swam away from his home, snakes coiling around his legs, that entire real estate holding was underwater, just as his own home was. He went down into the lower Ninth Ward, the house where he had grown up, and found his own father dead in the home, called, of course, the authorities. There's meant to be a protocol for handling a corpse. There was no doubt who this man was. His son was able to identify him. His own identification papers were on him. A month later, that body still lay in that house as Mr. Richardson had the extreme misfortune to go back to the property, assuming long since that the body had been removed. There it was, by then bloated, putrefied. And to cap it off, it was not until April, how many months is that? 6 months later, that the federal authorities, having finally processed this rotted corpse, released it to the family for a decent and proper burial. If you don't think that compounds the horror of something like Katrina, you got no soul at all.
Jed Horn, talk about the disparity in aid that has come to New Orleans versus what has gone to Mississippi.
Well, there's clearly a partisanship at play here, and there has been since the very first week of the storm. I think Louisiana, which suffered substantially more damage initially, was allocated only about half the per capita federal allocation of money for storm recovery. There's been kicking and screaming, and some of that imbalance has been rectified. Obviously, Mississippi, under Governor Barbour's administration, is an administration very pleasing to the White House. Barbour has been a prominent part of the Republican establishment for some time. Louisiana is a vestige of the old South, I suppose you could say. We have still Democrats in statewide office. We have a Democratic governor. She would not be considered a liberal by any standard. Outside of the South, she's a centrist. The mayor is a governor and could properly be called, is a Democrat, but could properly be called, I think, a neoconservative. He's as much a believer in the kind of free market, less is more approach to government as Karl Rove, one of his mentors. But there was clearly an effort as the Bush administration came under fire and began to look increasingly foolish and incompetent to blame somebody. And as often as not, that blame was assigned by contrasting Louisiana with Mississippi and blaming Louisiana for the failures of what was, after all, a federal levy system and its collapse.
Jed, I just wanted to interrupt for a second. You said the mayor, you're talking about Mayor Nagin, a protege
right.
of Karl Rove?
A subscriber to the same philosophy and a man pleased to chat with Rove on occasion when he's had contact with the White House.
And how has that affected the way New Orleans has dealt with, or the government of New Orleans has dealt with this?
Well, what Ray is about, and he's a man I respect, I hasten to say, I think he may be the wrong man at the wrong time. He believes, he subscribes to the philosophy that that market forces are the surest way to revive this economy. And that has invited, I fear, a kind of directionlessness. Two or three planning documents, that one of which importantly was put together by his own appointed Blue Ribbon Committee, have been effectively scuttled by the mayor, partly because of electoral politics. He had the misfortune to be up for re-election this past spring, and there were some tough calls that had to be made, and he was, I think, frankly, reluctant to make them and deferred on every instance to market forces, to the wisdom of the people, and so on. Well, we are wise people, and the market is a powerful engine, but we also need, I think, guidance through this kind of a mess. I went over to Kobe, Japan last fall to understand how that city, comparable in size and comparable in its devastation in 95 after an earthquake to what went on in New Orleans, had revived. And there the differences were salient. There were some similarities as well. But Kobe yielded to strong direction from its mayor, a moratorium on immediate rebuilding, which throws people at risk of simply rebuilding what was devastated and what will be devastated again, and has come out of this with a spanking and successful revival. It's taken them a long time, and we need to bear that in mind. It's going to take New Orleans a while, but there needs to be guidance. There needs to be a sense of purpose.
Finally, Jed Horn, your subtitle of Breach of Faith is Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City. Can you talk about how race has played into that, and if you do hold out hope?
I hold out great hope for New Orleans. New Orleans is an irrepressible force. The idea that you could not have a major city at the mouth of the continent's most important waterway is preposterous. We've heard foolishness to that effect in Congress. We shouldn't have a city there. Well, of course, you have to have a city there. And to speak of not rebuilding New Orleans, to have done other than throw everything at the rebuilding of New Orleans, including the Category 5 flood protections that we need, is decadent. This is a Republican administration that speaks proudly of its resistance to decadence. It is the height of decadence not to be rebuilding New Orleans to the state-of-the-art flood protection that it requires. Race, New Orleans is a black city. New Orleans will remain a black city, one hopes. It is its character, it is its essence.
Yet right now, we're talking about a city that has changed in its complexion. It's older, it's whiter, it's wealthier.
Yes, but
what
it
about
remains,
that difference?
It remains a substantially black city. It remains, as Rare Nagin's re-election attests, a majority black city. And therein lies our hope for the sustenance of the culture that is so important to New Orleans, not just, I mean, as a tourist draw and as a part of our economy, but as what Wynton Marsalis has called the soul of America. I mean, New Orleans, if New Orleans is worth saving, it's worth saving because of its culture, because of its music, because of its food. And all of that takes root in the Afro-American culture that has come our way from Africa through Haiti and other ports of call, in the Middle Passage, to this extraordinary place that we call New Orleans. It's not going away. We will perhaps be inconvenienced and slowed by clumsy and stupid governmental response. But the grassroots level is back. It is vigorous, and it is irrepressible.
And the explanation of how, in this year, they haven't made the levees be able to deal with a Hurricane 5 hurricane?
Well, that's not the work of a year. That's the work of a long period of time, perhaps 10 years. What is disgusting in this year is the reluctance, the failure to commit whole hog and with adequate financing to that goal. The Army Corps itself, having finally acknowledged that its own designs were at fault and that this engineering catastrophe was its own doing, developed a road forward that would require and obligate the government to immediate preparation for Category 5 construction. The Bush administration stripped that language out of the Army Corps report, we're told, and instead committed to a study of the possibility that we will someday have a Category 5, as we call it, a state-of-the-art flood protection. What's needed right now is the commitment, because in a land that has an attention deficit disorder, New Orleans is going to be forgotten too quickly. And every politician knows that. Some perhaps are hoping for that. We need the federal commitment, the congressional commitment now to a long-term financing scheme for the construction of a state-of-the-art flood defense. Governor Blanco sees one in offshore oil revenues finally being allocated to Louisiana on a regular basis with which we could finance our own state-of-the-art flood defense. We have to hope that that happens.
Jed Horn, thank you very much for being with us. An editor at the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his part in the Times-Picayune coverage of Hurricane Katrina. His book is called Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina and the Near Death of a Great American City. Joining us from the studios of WLAE, also hit by Hurricane Katrina. When we come back, we'll be joined by a housing activist who we have visited over the year, Tracy Washington, and we'll also speak with a law professor about the state of the criminal justice system in New Orleans. Stay with us.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds roll in from the north and it start to rain. Rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River had busted through, clear down the Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana, Louisiana, that tide will wash us away. That tide will wash us away. Louisiana, Louisiana, that tide will wash us away. Child wash us away. President Cooley's come down.
Randy Newman, Louisiana, 1927, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A year after Hurricane Katrina hit, barely half of New Orleans' population of 450,000 has returned. Many of those unable to come back are poor and African American. In the ravaged, mostly black neighborhood of the Lower Ninth Ward, only 1,000 of the 20,000 people who lived there before Katrina have returned. This has drastically altered the demographics of a city that used to be two-thirds black. Activists and residents have condemned the government's refusal to reopen the city's public housing projects and point out that while tourist areas are being developed, affordable housing is not being built. That all seemed to change yesterday in what appeared to be a surprise announcement from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Speaking before 1,000 construction industry members at a privately organized conference in Louisiana, Governor Kathleen Blanco and New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin both introduced what appeared to be a HUD official.
Today, all 10 road home housing centers are open across the state and servicing homeowners. And I want to thank Secretary Jackson. Renee, would you please give him our thank you?
And also I want to stop and thank Renee, who's here from HUD. HUD has been an incredible partner with us.
Dear friends, it is with the greatest joy that I announce to you today a brand new Department of Housing and Urban Development. Everything is going to change about the way we work, and the change is going to start right here today in New Orleans.
That supposed senior HUD official, Renee Oswin, was actually Andy Bicklebaum, a member of the political pranksters group, the Yes Men. Posing as Oswin, Bicklebaum went on to announce grandiose plans for HUD to reverse course in New Orleans, such as scrapping plans to demolish 5,000 housing units, spending $180 million to fund one public health clinic per housing development, having Walmart withdraw its stores from poor neighborhoods, and having energy giants Exxon and Shell spend $8.6 billion to finance wetlands rebuilding. The prank was just the latest in a series pulled off by the Yes Men, who've recently masqueraded as representatives of McDonald's, of Halliburton, and Dow Chemical. They went on BBC and they apologized for Bhopal, and then Dow Chemical had to say no, they were not apologizing for Bhopal. Well, soon after Bickelbaum's announcement, HUD confirmed he wasn't part of their agency. HUD spokesperson Donna White called the hoax sick and twisted, but not everyone felt that way. Here's one New Orleans contractor's reaction.
I'm not angry at them for pulling this joke. I'm angry that it's not for real.
If you didn't quite hear that, she said, I'm not angry that it's a hoax. I'm angry that it's not for real. Well, for more on the issue of public housing on this Katrina anniversary, Tracy Washington joins us from the New Orleans public TV station WLAE. And our shout out to friends at the public television station there. Tracy Washington is a lifelong New Orleans resident and a civil rights attorney. She's also the director of the NAACP Gulf Coast Advocacy Center. Welcome, Tracy, to Democracy Now! Once again.
Thank you so much for having me on, Amy.
Your response to that hoax, to this supposed HUD official saying they're going to turn things around?
Well, you know, the public housing residents, unfortunately, have heard so many rumors, heard so many lies, have heard so many misstatements, and have been forced to go through so many missteps. What we've tried to do, and unfortunately we've had to do through litigation, is get at the truth so that individuals know what their destiny will be and that they have the opportunity to take part in planning that destiny.
Right now, a year later, as we look at these figures, for example, the Lower Ninth Ward, 20,000 people live there, only 1,000 have returned.
And that's really ridiculous at this point. We've had public services return to almost every part of the city, actually every part of the city, except portions of the Lower Ninth Ward. Now, we hear from public officials that, well, you know, the services can't be restored there. It was just absolutely too devastated. No one's buying it any longer. You know, after a certain point, you lose credibility as an administration. And they've lost credibility with the folks in the Lower Ninth Ward because in many instances you can't get lights, you can't get telephone services, the water is not yet potable. That's ridiculous. If this administration, from the state government to the local government, wants to retain its credibility and not have its words, we will rebuild every area of the city seem empty and shallow, then it's got to act on those words and promises.
And the issue of yesterday, we played a piece by Greg Pallas, goes to a public housing project. It was not submerged. It was not hit by the water. And yet the residents are not allowed to return home. Their homes are boarded up.
And ultimately, what happens then, and I believe what many folks saw yesterday and will continue to see throughout this week, is residents of public housing taking matters into their own hands. They have already, which has not been really advertised, with individuals now living in their apartments without electricity and without water, but needing a place to stay and living there. And then public actions beginning yesterday and continuing today, where public residents say, enough. We're taking back the public housing units, for example, like the Lafitte and like apartment, like units inside the Iberville, and we're just going to stay. And I don't know what the government's response is going to be to that, but you can only push so far, Amy, with folks, and then they push back. And we're beginning to see pushback at this point, and I cannot condemn that because they are simply reacting to the failure of this government to do something positive for them.
Can you talk about the education system? Is New Orleans being used now as a way to model charter schools when you had, for example, a number of months ago, all the teachers of New Orleans fired?
If this is a model for chartering schools in the nation, we are in severe trouble. This state decided in the fall absurdly to engage in an experiment, and the statute states that this is an experiment with our children, that it was going to take over all of the schools, show us it could do better by engaging chartering organizations to come in and use new models for education in this community. Well, that's not what happened. First of all, most chartering organizations didn't come in droves to take over schools in New Orleans. That's number one. Number two, the state, which never wanted to run schools in the city of New Orleans, Cecil Picard said, and he's our state superintendent, he didn't want to run schools down here. Well, then they were, quote, stuck with opening schools. And it has been a haphazard process with bureaucrats in the state of Louisiana Department of Education trying to figure out how do you open doors, how do you get books ordered inside of schools, how do we order security, cafeteria, transportation. What ultimately we've seen, Amy, is that there was a promise that 56 schools would be opening this fall. We have, you know, a portion of that number of schools being opened. Many of the schools are still in a state of disrepair. And we have tiered levels of education here such that if you are in elite charter schools, you get excellent services on the one hand, but you may not get the same quality of services on the other hand. Yet the elite charter schools may not offer services for all, such that special education children, children with special education needs may not be serviced. Children who need transportation to and from school will not be serviced. My son cannot get transportation to and from school. If you're not a stay-at-home mom, if you can't get off work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, where are you if you want to get your child into one of the elite schools? Because they will not provide transportation. That's ridiculous. If this is a model for the country, then our poor and frankly, our African-American children will not be educated. They will be underserved.
We're also joined today by a law professor as we look at the criminal justice system, also joining us from public television station WLAE in New Orleans. A New Orleans judge has pledged to begin releasing prisoners today whose cases have been delayed since Hurricane Katrina. Many prisoners jailed in New Orleans for over a year haven't talked to a lawyer or had a day in court. Some have yet to be charged with a crime. Judge Arthur Hunter announced last month he'll begin reviewing prisoners today on a case-by-case basis. Judge Arthur said, quote, "It's something the entire country should be concerned about. If we're still part of the United States and the Constitution still means something, why is the New Orleans criminal justice system still in shambles?" That's the question of the judge. Well, Catherine Mattis joins us now from New Orleans. She's a law professor at Tulane University and deputy director of the university's criminal law clinic. What is the state of the criminal justice system in New Orleans right now, Professor Mattis?
Good morning, Amy. The devastation that occurred, that devastated the criminal justice system at Katrina, is continued to this day. We have, as you mentioned, and as Judge Hunter identified, we have people who've been in custody before Katrina and remained in custody and have to this day never spoken to a lawyer, have never been in court. What happened is we had a system that was, prior to Katrina, a system that was barely functioning. And when Katrina hit, all the systems that compose the criminal justice system, the sheriffs, the district attorneys, the courts, the public defenders, all those systems failed. And that failure continues today. Unfortunately, during the hurricane, the inmates of the prison system here in New Orleans were not evacuated. They remained in custody at the jails in the central city part of New Orleans, which was flooded. The conditions that they remained in were horrendous. When they finally were evacuated, they were evacuated throughout the state. Those inmates remained throughout the state. When they were evacuated, their records were not taken with them. They were taken to different facilities throughout the state, Department of Correction facilities, as well as local parish facilities, local jails, and who they were, where they were, what charges they were being held on, all that information was lost. It was not transported with them. So unfortunately, what's happened is those people still remain out throughout the state of Louisiana, and we are still finding people every day who have not yet been to court, who have no lawyer representing them, whose interests have not been protected. They've been through horrendous experiences, both in the evacuation. They have no idea where their families are. Many of them, their families don't know where they are. And what's unfortunate is a year later, this situation still exists.
What about the number of public defenders?
Well, what you have to understand is pre-Katrina, the public defender system was inadequate. We had a system of approximately 42 public defenders who are part-time public defenders. They were funded largely from funds that were assessed from convictions, particularly traffic convictions. Judge Hunter, as well as Judge Johnson, have ruled that the statute that provided that funding is an unconstitutional statute. That case and that situation still has to be presented before the Supreme Court. But what happened was, once again, the funding was, if you were arrested and you were convicted or pled guilty to a charge, you were assessed a fee, and that fee then funded the public defender's office. The majority of those fees came from traffic tickets, and of course, after Katrina, there were no traffic tickets, so there was no money. And so the public defender's office went from an office of approximately 42 part-time public defenders to an office of four. You're talking about an office of four lawyers who, in theory, represent all the indigent criminal defendants in Orleans Parish. And that number, the number of people in the jail when it was evacuated, was approximately 6,500 people. So you're talking about four attorneys who are representing 6,500 people. And what was particularly distressing is, because the public defender's office prior to Katrina was poorly organized, poorly staffed, inadequately staffed, they didn't have enough lawyers doing enough full-time work, but they had no system to know who their clients were, who they represented. So when these people were dispersed throughout the state of Louisiana, there was no one to say, this is my list of clients, this is the office's list of clients, let's find out where these people are, let's find out if they don't belong in jail, if their sentences are over, or if they've served more time than the maximum sentence for the charge they were arrested, let's make sure that they are released. And that never happened. Currently, what's the public defender's office has gotten some funding, and they have hired more public defenders, but they're still far below the levels of representation that's required to serve the people who are in custody today.
Catherine Matteys, I want to thank you for joining us. Law Professor at Tulane, and Tracy Washington for joining us as well. A longtime New Orleans resident and civil rights attorney, director of the NAACP Gulf Coast Advocacy Center. As we end with the words of a person who had to flee because of Hurricane Katrina, not New Orleans, but Mobile, Alabama, and she hasn't been able to return. Her name is Joetta Rogers. She spoke out last night in New York.
I spent 2 days sitting in the Salvation Army waiting area in Mobile, Alabama, begging and pleading for some help, and was confronted by a social worker with an attitude problem toward those of us in need. And she made us suffer by handling and treating us like we were poison, contagious, or nothing. And then I went to Red Cross for assistance and have them to tell me that because of the zip code that I lived in, and there were only houses in my area that sustained severe damage, they could not help me. Then I came to New York with only $1.55 in my pocket after riding 32 hours on a bus and being stuck at Port Authority for 7 hours and having a Red Cross worker tell me that she wanted me to walk from 42nd and 8th Avenue to 66th in Amsterdam for some help. And sixth and my final thing was, from November to May, it took me just that long, talking to about 200 FEMA operators to get okay for rental assistance. And I want you to know something about the FEMA operators on that hotline. They're the most rudest people. They talk to us like we dogs. You understand? They talk to us like that's their money. Now, I want to tell you something. I'm mad. And the reason why I'm mad and I'm really, really ready to fight is because why should I have to go back to FEMA and ask them?
The words of Joetta Rogers. She couldn't return yet to her home. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining me.